coming to you from the City of the Weird. Exploring topics from the esoteric and unexplored to dimensions unknown. Shining a light of truth on the darkest corners of our reality. Welcome to the Curious Realm. Hello, everybody. Hello. Welcome. Happy 4th of July, everyone. I should have brought a sparkler in to have on air. That's dangerous enough here in the home studio. Happy 4th of July, everybody. You could not get better than doing this show on Independence Day. I say that because our original incarnation over my right shoulder, right there behind me, that little... trying to point at it, and I'm doing a mirror. The little underneath the two Bigfoot, you'll see a little placard. That is our News and Politics Award from our days as the Dudes and Beer podcast. And the whole concept when this show started was having conversations that other people weren't willing to have. They were afraid to lose a friendship or something like that. And it didn't matter if we agreed or disagreed, we were willing to have the conversation and come back the next week as friends. And that led to a lot of different topics. That led down esoteric roads. That led to wild guests, all kinds of things. And I thank every day for the fact that our audience went through that transformation with us, saw that transformation happen before their eyes, and that... we started with the concept of America was founded in a bar. The fact that the public house is where everybody went, whether you were the mayor, the pig farmer, didn't matter. Everybody went to the public house. And whether or not they had the same lifestyle, they all agreed on one thing. They didn't like that and what was happening with it. And they took it into their own hands and made it all happen. So... thank you so much to our founding fathers. Thank you to everybody who has served our country. Happy 4th of July, everybody. Happy Independence Day. With that in mind, let's hop on over to one of the greatest things about our country, the news, the media, the preservation of the first. Let's check out the news over on the Curious Realm Facebook page. Hop on by, folks. Follow us on Facebook. Join the Curious Realm group. You can join the conversation, post articles. You couldn't get more American than our first article out of KHOU.com. Joey Chestnut down 62 hot dogs to win the 16th Nathan's hot dog eating contest. 62 hot dogs. Imagine that. Wow. I'm trying to just do the quick head math of hot dogs to buns there, and it almost broke my brain. out of USA Today, cocaine found in the West Wing of the White House while President Biden was away. What we know, that out of USAtoday.com, out of REFERL.org, a Russian volunteer soldier was forced to return to the front and ended up committing suicide instead. There is another version of the U.S. Secret Service investigating cocaine reportedly found. A hammerhead shark spotted in shallow Florida waters sent swimmers fleeing. That's a wild video. And out of New York Times, bison return to Native American lands, revitalizing sacred rituals. All that and more right there in the Curious Realm Facebook group, folks. Stop on by, join the group. Join the conversation. While you are online doing that, make sure to stop on by, follow the page of our guest, Keith Seeland. Thehumaniverse.org is his website. That is where you can find his books. You can also find his books, of course, at the Curious Realm store. Welcome back to the program, Keith Seeland. We will be talking with you tonight about your recent presentation at Roswell. You are still presently in Roswell right now. I'd like to thank you so much for joining us from such an awesome location on the 4th of July. And sharing with us always your information and knowledge about petroglyphs, your research into this ancient societies, or ancient cultures rather, and their use of petroglyphs at sacred sites, things like that.
Thanks a lot again, Chris, for having me on, and hello everybody. I am still in Roswell, and able to participate in the, I believe it was the 33rd annual Roswell UFO Festival.
Wow.
And it was very successful. All of them get a little more successful as they go along. So it was 3 days of fun, of education. And, you know, for the audience listening, if you want the most recent details on research findings and whatnot, when you go to television, there's a delay inherent in that process. You want to go to these conferences. Yeah. And you'll pick up the information and the knowledge first, and then many months or a year or a couple of years later, you're going to find it on mainstream television. That's just the way it is when the researchers have their stuff. So, I was very busy with a couple of lectures, a panel, and I had the opportunity and was grateful for a Facebook Live interview with local historian Donald Schmidt.
Oh, fantastic.
He's got a laundry list of books. I've lost count, actually, on them. But basically, if you see a book or a media production that has the word Roswell in it, you can bet that Donald had a hand in the production in one way or another. So you can see that Facebook Live interview on my Facebook page, which all of my social media YouTube channel, whatnot, you can keyword the Humaniverse, and that will get you over to basically the screen comes up, and it's basically everything about the Humaniverse guide, and will guide you into my Facebook, the website, which is under renovation right now, and the YouTube channel. So, we can dive into Roswell and, recent findings and recent additions.
Yeah, absolutely. Because once again, you just came back from a trip to Egypt, kind of a research trip. You're getting ready to head to a trip to Göbekli Tepe. And you were just busy before that, scouring the Southwest for petroglyphs, things like that. Tell us a little bit about your presentation that you just gave there in Roswell.
Chris, I preface my presentations by saying to everybody, please follow me for the long term, because this is going to be an addition by addition by addition. With my thesis of world ancient civilizations, it's going to be something that's going to be added to for a long, long, long time to come. I'm not waiting for, researching for many years to come up with enough material for a book or series of books or whatever. I'm kind of doing it a little bit more immediate. I'll get some data and then I'll bring it forward, and also in the way working that towards research papers and the books and things like that. So that's what I introduce my audience with, saying, hey, if you want to follow along, it's going to be a long, great ride, and there's lots of media outlets that I do function with, so you'll be able to follow me real easy. But my lecture in Roswell, the subject, the thesis, essentially has these main thinking talking points for reflection that I introduce my audience to. You'll want to be thinking about spiritualism, cosmic connections, whatnot, with our modern day society and the road that we're driving towards. I don't want to say disclosure, but global acknowledgement that other intelligences of an extraterrestrial nature exist. They have existed and have been visiting us since recorded history. Now, where I kind of take the history lessons and the learning and kind of project that into the future to help our society prepare and plan for the ultimate, what I call Enduring Global Acknowledgement, or EGA, and also the relationships that are going to come from that, or my acronym is EGR. So if you hear me talk EGA, EGR, you'll know what I mean by those things. There's no, in the literature, there's very, very little of any planning that's being done or that has been done over the many decades going way back into the 20th century. There's the occasional academic paper and then, you know, a little bit of discussion amongst some researchers, and then it just kind of fades away. And then there's a little bit of material from one of the most frequent contributors, the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence, or SETI, yeah, which I think most people have heard of. So, you know, their thesis is, let's look for a message. Well, there's not all that much talk. What's going to go on after that message? We receive it, and either we need to translate it or it's translated for us. What happens all after that? Or what happens when the government will disclose, the world governments will disclose that ET exists? That could happen. Or ET could just decide to come down on their own and say, hey, yeah, we are here and everything. Well, there's no plan of action, nothing in place for any of that. So you keep that thought in mind throughout all of my presentations and my continuing research. But then also I bring in, you know, the fact that, as I mentioned, circling a minute ago, that our ancient cultures, that there has been recordings that we have been visited since recorded history. And that's my search around the world for our ancient cultures to, you know, kind of come up with evidence and showing us today. And another thinking point for us is to let us hopefully compel us to look back on our ancients and to help us design that plan of action for the future. That's the subject of my current book, Will ET Talk With Us? I propose that we do a proactive plan of action in light of that. And then I say, as a premise, let's look back on our ancient cultures, which is what I've been doing, including more than a handful of years now in the Southwest America, mostly petroglyph research. And that's been expanded now, starting on the world stage, which is my purpose for going to Egypt just a couple weeks ago, and coming up in Turkey later on this year. I have been invited also at a future time to go to Australia and study the Aborigines for a while, and then also to Nepal, which is kind of a hidden little nook and corner in the world landscape. So all of those are going to be searching for evidence, and it's beyond obvious. It's apparent that we have our ancients were visited since recorded history, like I said, and a lot of the curious and what I call universals, that's another concept that I will talk about a lot. I'll mention universals. And what that means is that each of our ancient civilizations in which we today still are in agreement that they were not supposed to have traveled to see each other, but yet all of our ancient civilizations came up with these ways of life, the moral codes, the tree of life, tree of knowledge, their deep, profound harmony and peace and resonance with their environment, their universe, the spiritualism. And I don't mean spiritualism even so much in the religious sense, but the spiritualism that comes with the cosmic connections and the consciousness that they had and the holism that they had. We know today about all of those terms that I just mentioned and the concepts behind them, but yet we don't practice a lot of them at all. So that's in bringing all that around together into one big ball. That's my quest, is to look for evidence of our ancients, and that they had these connections not only with gods, deities, but also ETs, in helping guide and structure their ways of life.
Absolutely. And once again, the one thing that I love that you drive home in your work is that Petroglyphs are not rock art. What I have up on screen right now, folks, is rock art. You see animals that live around the area, you know, things like that. Like this is some rock art from the Amazon. You see some images of everyday life. You see some images of people hunting, stuff like that. When you're talking petroglyphs, that is when you're talking creation stories. That's when you're talking origin stories. That's when you're talking star people who came from other places and told us things. Things like that, like the amazing panel that you captured, in the Southwest that I've got up on screen right now. But phenomenal stuff.
Oh yeah, that's the famous iconic. That's one of the panels at Sago Canyon. This is, you know, also too, as we talk here, I'd like to hopefully interject as much as I can in terms of those of the audience that might be interested in visiting some panels in their future, to give them little tips in terms of being able to maybe start to interpret, or a couple of little tips and encounters when they come up upon a panel, to instead of just looking at it as art, they can actually, it could be interpretive for them, and that they could start actually you know, making some meaning, a little bit of meaning of the panels. Now, I mean, it's the Native America, there's, unfortunately, we don't have their version of the Rosetta Stone that allowed us to learn about the ancient Egypt civilization.
Yeah.
It's been a lot more of a many more piece jigsaw puzzle to be able to put together. And I think eventually we will get to that stage. It'll take a while. But in any event, what you're looking at there is this panel is one of the concept, the terminology differences between a petroglyph by definition and a pictograph. What you see there is a pictograph. It is painted on. That's the main difference between that and a petroglyph, which is pecked or chipped into. So what you see there, this Sago here is readily available for anybody. Again, has some little bit more esoteric and hard to decipher. This is a work in progress as far as being able to determine the communications. And again, this is not art, and I rail against this in the art professions. Archaeologists title their books Rock Art of the Four Corners of the American Southwest or whatever, and then the behavior like a newspaper will bury a disclaimer on page 31 saying, oh yeah, no, I know that this isn't art, it's communication. Well, you know, that does a disservice to the reader. So
it would be the equivalent of calling Psalms just poetry, Keith. Because this is, no, once again, even if you ask the tribes, the people whose ancestors made these sagos and these panels, they will tell you that it's like, you want to see the rock art of us hunting and things like that. Like, that's over here.
Yep.
Those panels, things like that, normally aren't on, quote, sacred ground, things like that. Correct?
Yeah. And I mean, we're all guilty of it, the professionals and the lay people. Our society is typically, and, you know, too, just being in Egypt a few weeks ago, over there, they do the same thing. You know, it's art. It's called art. And all of these ancient languages, whether they be phonetic, a little more advanced like Egypt, or like the Aborigines or the Native America, which used a mental process called ideography, in which we use that today. But there's very profound and deep meaning within their artistry, within their authorship or scripting of the stories on the panels that they, you know, that they present for us. So, I mean, you know, as an example here, on this one, yes, they do. They did occasionally all, and this is one of the universals that I talk about amongst all ancient civilizations. Remember too, all the ancient civilizations were popularized by human beings. They were human. We are human beings today. We share the same DNA. It's reasonable. And I've asked a biologist about this details at another time or later. But our DNA can be reasonably substituted or transferred into our ancients. So they are us. We are them. They all came up with these universal ideas. And amongst the communications that they did, they often depicted big events in their lives. They did also to depict you know, day to day activities. And Egypt is a little more popular at that amongst the, especially the pharaoh's temples and whatnot. They did describe daily life there as part of this scene in America here, the Native Americans. But they also did in their panels talk and describe larger events, a great hunt, a war. They also did navigation directions, and that's kind of unique. Many other world cultures didn't do that, but in Native America, partly to do with the terrain and the more basic human needs for survival, such as where is there a water a source of water that may be hidden, food, whatnot. Some of their symbolism and semiotics can be used as navigation devices. And that's a complexity with trying to read petroglyphs, especially, or glyphs, I'll just call them glyphs, is that you have to determine a context to particular symbol can have different contexts within different panels, different stories. So there's some variables for you to, as a potential viewer or visitor to a glyph site or a panel or a story or whatever, you know, starting to interpret it. You'll have to remember that, with this in mind, that, sometimes depending on what the story was being told, you know, the use of the symbols, it's like a jigsaw puzzle. You know, you put the first two pieces together, but that's often the hardest part of the puzzle. And that's another dimension of glyphs, is to find the starting point. They didn't necessarily have the left to right convention critical thinking that we do today. Sometimes they used right to left. Sometimes they used up to down. So finding that entry point into the story is a little bit, can be daunting, and that to me represents the first two pieces of the jigsaw puzzle. Now, taking a look here at the Sago panel, for example, another dimension that maybe adds to the complexity a little bit is that, you know, people may think that, well, this is one story here, and this panel is not one story. This is an example of the dimension where... oh no, go ahead, Chris.
I was going to say precisely, this is an example of where you have more than one person contributing to the story of this panel.
Yeah, there's
contributing their story to the story of the panel.
Right. And I mean, you know, it's to say that, you know, they have limited space, limited easel space. So you'll find that many stories contained within. You'll find also what I call a temporal dimension, which means, and partly dependent on the supply and demand of the easel space available, you'll find that some stories maybe overlap, but the reason that they just ran out of space. So you could be facing at a panel here that could be that could last or be telling stories from hundreds or maybe even 1,000 years or more. I don't know if you have a panel there. There was also, I found further up in Sago Canyon, there was another panel that has to do with what I've decoded as a part of it as the Tree of Life. And I can't remember whether I gave it to you or if whether there's a demonstration, but I can describe it. But and that ties in really good with one of my examples of the resources that all our ancient cultures came up with to describe a moral code or a description of the way of life there. Okay, that's not going to be it. But that's okay. You know, and as you can see here, nope, that's a little bit different also. And that is actually, I think you're getting into another Great Gallery, Horseshoe Canyon.
Previous images that you have sent me. Of things from your previous research into petroglyphs, things like that. There in the canyons, and it's fascinating to me, especially whenever you start going through. We had a listener, Ryan Mills, mention of, I bet that they were Polynesian. What have you seen any kind of familiarity between these symbologies? Because I mean, of course, I've been like I've told you off air before, I've been writing an album about petroglyphs, using many of the geometric images that are within petroglyphs to make the sounds that the images are, I think, representing. But whenever you look, even at that image from the Amazon, the panel from that, you can see things like water. And it's interesting how, there are 18 different ways that you could probably associate the wave of water, but it's interesting how hieroglyphs, Amazon, Native American, all of them represent water as a triangular shape.
And again, that leads back around to my point, Chris, where never fail to remember that all of our ancients were us. We are them. They were all human beings. Our thought processes on many major levels is precisely the same.
Yeah.
As they were back then. What they did and what we do today is we write, we perceive what we see. That's maybe to make a statement that out of all of our senses, maybe the sense of sight is our most dominant and maybe preferred. If you ask an individual, if you had only one sense to have, what would it be? And I think maybe the largest amount would say your eyesight. So they drew what they saw. We draw what we see. What we see today, we interpret it, and that's a universal that exists throughout the world. So when you come to depictions such as water. Yes, I mean, you just showed an example of a universal. The Aborigines drew water the same way. Egypt actually drew water in exactly the same way. And in fact, it became one of the letters of the Old Kingdom Egypt alphabet, the letter N, which is just the water current, like you see in this petroglyph right here, a pictograph actually. So the letter N was derived from what their life revolved around the Nile River. So water was extremely important to them, as is to any human civilization. They came up with this universal to describe water. They're just trying to translate, interpret, perceive, and communicate what they saw.
Absolutely. And, you know, there has been a hypothesis out there for a long time. Of course, there are stories of caves of Phoenician artifacts being found in the American Southwest. There are stories of hieroglyphic tablets with ancient Hebrew on them, all kinds of things. Did you see any similarities between cultures, anything like that, while you were there in Egypt and doing your research there amongst petroglyphs, things like that.
Yeah, again, many universals, such as the descriptions or the stories that were actually displayed, again, in many major ways, talk of great events. Now, in Egypt, it's centered often around the royalty, the pharaohs, as, you know, pretty much in all the others in America. It was the chiefs and the shamans and the high priests, as it was in Egypt, the pharaohs, the viziers, the royalty, royal families and extendeds. So that's a universal in and of itself. One big difference, for instance, in Egypt, is that most of the writings that at least have been found, you know, up to this point in time, is centric around the royalty. I mean, there was not really a billboard, so to speak, for the common people or the people that the farmers or the ones that the constructions labor for building the pyramids, for example, or any of the temples, whatnot. Occasionally, yes, high priests had their own time for being able to, you know, put their authorship on some particular panels and whatnot. But just the concept of why they did these things, as in all ancient cultures, was that as a communication to their descendants, which include us, you know, even many thousands of years later. Most of the world's cultures, Egypt is a little bit more advanced in that they came the closer to a written language that we are used to today. They had phonetics, in which they were able to actually write letters, how I put this, individual letters. It's a consonant-based format, whereas most of the other cultures really didn't do that. They concentrated on the ideology, which is what I call a two-step process. It's simpler than the three-step process of assimilating a language like we have today. We also have the ideologies. Anybody, after our talk tonight, go outside and get in your car and drive, and you'll, within two blocks, see an example of ideology in the traffic signs or whatnot. They're easier to interpret. You see visually, you see the sign. You don't need to your brain doesn't need to translate it into a language. You see the sign for a curve in the road, or if you go to a public place, the bathroom, you'll see, you know, men's, women's, handicapped, whatever. You know what it is. You don't need to have that third step to translate through your brain and into your hands or whatever to be able to then decipher what that message is. So that's a little bit of a different with Egypt, but the rest of the world cultures, the symbolism is pretty universal. And I got another little bit of a tidbit here.
Please
I want to mention it. Okay. One of my friends, a researcher, Anthony Perrott. Robert Schock is my friend. He's a long-time geologist, professor at Boston University. He's been working with Anthony Perrott, who is a physicist who has discovered, and I believe Perrott does have a couple of publications out, where they talk, and their research is centered on ancient civilizations, but to do with the melting of the ice age and the solar sun activity, which precipitated the melting of the glaciers and then a thousand year cooling down in the middle of the warm up, but then rebounding to where we are today. Anthony Perrott noticed in his laboratory experiments that to do with plasma, that in the imagery that in their experiments that they took, they noticed that there were many symbols that appeared to visually, at least according to his interpretation, to coincide and somewhat match with some of the panels that they have witnessed throughout the world and concentrated on Aborigine Australia. I believe he also has mentioned there's a place in South America that so in other words, what happened was when like we just had a couple of days ago, sunspot and the EM electromagnetic yep. Pulse that glanced off of Earth just a couple of days ago. At the height, and there are, it's cyclical, the sunspot activity and whatnot. There is a pattern cycle to it. So what happened back then was that when these EMPs and EMFs would be transmitted and hit planet Earth, some of them causing, plasma, ejections to where, potential for witnesses to see the imagery in the sky. And Peratt's thesis is that the ancients then took those imageries and reported it, inscribed it on the glyph panels. And in his laboratory experiments, some of the images do match pretty decent with some symbols that have been found on panels, especially in Aborigine Australia and in South America. Now, I haven't seen a ton of his work, but what I've seen of it, there isn't any examples in Native America where that plasma symbolism, I'll call it, that they may have witnessed. But also, too, he's going back. Remember the temporal nature of this, which is very important. You can't forget that. That these EMF EMP activities were happening 10,000-12,000 years ago, and in the cyclical yeah. nature, the sun is active for a couple thousand years maybe, and then it calms down for 10,000 or so years, maybe more, and then it's it regenerates, and the sine wave, so to speak, comes forth, and then you get you ramp up for the amplitude, you ramp up for another cycle. So we're talking going back maybe 10,000-12,000 years ago. Native America is the oldest current manifestation or our knowledge dating of at least United States glyph activity goes back to an archaic period, which does go back, it's estimated 8,000 or so years ago, maybe a little bit longer, but there's still kind of a time lag between that and the 12,000 that they're talking about with the sun cycle activity coming to a maximum, the melting of the ice age and the plasma emissions that manifest in the potential visuals that the natives did see in the skies at those times.
Well, and you know, that brings up a question real quick once again about panels like the panel that you provided the video of. Were these stories being recorded for the average person? Were they being recorded for the initiate? What were these? Because obviously, yes, they are recording what they saw and what they experienced that was on a different level than, hey, look, we're hunting a buffalo. But were they intended to be interpreted by the average person, by the average member of the tribe, or were they intended for the medicine people and those that were initiate into that knowledge?
For sure, Chris. There's universals that the main activity and a main audience would be for the special members of that society, but in Native America, these panels were in the wide open. I mean, they were potentially easily accessible for anybody within their tribes. And
was the symbology known by everybody in the tribe? I guess is my question. You know, because it's not as though like the average person could be walking down the street of Egypt and see an obelisk with hieroglyphs on it, but the hieroglyphs weren't the average writing of the of the language of Egypt. You know, I mean, that's kind of like saying everybody was roaming around Rome speaking Latin. That's not how that worked.
That's right. And especially in Egypt, a little bit more sophisticated form of communication in the written variety with their phonetic alphabet and whatnot. Yes. Most of their population was not literate. The temples and the crypts and the pyramids, yes, they were meant for royalty, and in fact they had and still maintain very strict codes that these were not accessible by the commoner, so to speak.
Yeah.
So and they were physically prevented from actually seeing these, whereas in Native America or elsewhere throughout the world, Mesopotamia and South America, Peru and around the world, that they were certainly in the wide open. So they were accessible physically. Whether they were able to be interpreted is my guess is that that's another universal that they weren't really so much totally meant for the common people, although I believe that there are elements in which a commoner in that particular culture may have had an experience of some kind, and just naturally, according to their way of life and codes and whatever, if a commoner had a particular experience of some kind, well, naturally they'd go to the chief or the shaman or the high priests. And maybe tell of the story, and then they would take care of it. In other words, the high priests and the shaman and the chiefs, maybe they were the publishers, and they were the publishers and the authors, basically. So maybe to put it in that way is to say that, well, the commoners really didn't contribute all that much to it. And then also, too, you look at, the evidence of back then, all of these ancient lives, it was more difficult. I mean, they had to spend more of their time looking for food, water, agriculture, providing enough for the tribe and whatnot. That took up most of their time anyways, where the specialized craftspeople, which included the priests and the shamans and or viziers or, ministers to royalty or whatever the civilization was.
Yeah.
They were the ones that were more so involved. It wasn't for the common people. It was, more pointed towards their descendants. I mean, the way that they made these things, and this is universal, we're looking at communications, we're looking at architecture, we're looking at building structures from thousands of years ago, and I'm going to be walking and touching stuff that's now dated 12, 13 or more thousand years ago.
Yeah.
And they still exist today.
Yeah. Yeah, precisely. And especially whenever you're talking about locations like Göbekli Tepe, once again, not even discovered until, was it 2014 almost? Right up around there?
Actually, Chris, this goes back to the 1960s.
Oh, does it? Okay,
Yes. Now, before Klaus Schmidt, who was generally credited, the German archaeologist, in 1960s, there was knowledge and uncovering of the first couple of mounds in Göbekli. And it was decided amongst the archaeology profession that these things potentially had the, in other words, it was rocking the boat, if these things were exposed, because there was conjecture that these things are way older than what they felt comfortable with. So they kind of just covered it up. And then Klaus Schmidt in 1991, I believe it was, he had gone back there a few times and was uncovering more. And then he had to decide on his own, was he going to maintain the status quo in the archaeology community, or was he going to be what's called a paradigm buster? You know, the old Thomas Kuhn word, paradigm, that we hate today. But so he had to make a decision. He also knew that if he was going to make the decision to bust the paradigm, that was going to be his life's work. He decided to do that. So the next year in 1992 was when the excavation started. So, and it continues today. It's estimated that I think only maybe 4 or 5% of the entire landscape of Göbekli has been uncovered. And since those decades, there's been more than a handful of other sites uncovered, and we're going to be visiting Karahan Tepe, another sister site to Göbekli, which is geographically just over the hill, so to speak. But and you know, also too, Chris, I was going to say that what the future holds for us in terms of new discoveries, that's kind of one of the most fascinating aspects of our existence, and adding our culture, adding to our knowledge, is what's yet to be discovered.
Well, you know, and that is the beautiful thing, to bring it right back to Roswell disclosure, big D disclosure, as we said with Stephen Bassett a few weeks ago. The fact that we are now having a different conversation, Keith, the fact that we now need to be looking at things like your Humaniverse guide, the fact that we now need to be looking toward, yes, that intergalactic representative of the UN, who I believe is still a Korean lady, if I'm not mistaken, a great lady from South Korea, was our first planetary representative at the UN. And that was right up around 2012 that office was very quietly put out there. But people like you, people who are worried about the world of exopolitic, about the idea of fantastic, great UAP studies, everything else, awesome that we're looking at that. Are we ready to deal with that conversation with them? Never mind the conversation with ourselves. Are we as a humanity ready to talk to them? Are we ready to handle that?
And that is the circling around of moving on to my thesis, when I show everybody that our ancient civilizations had many experiences that we've been visited for many thousands as recorded history, whatever. Mm. And then circle that as the evidence portion, evidence. And then the analysis in the landscape today, like you said, answering a big question, are we ready for it? Well, there's nobody that's actually taking a deep dive into this particular question. In my new book and in my lecture series ongoing, I point out that we are, as a species, humankind, reactive by nature. My proposal. Absolutely. Yes. I mean, you've got many examples. I know we're sick and tired of hearing COVID, but there you go. We had common knowledge of it.
Well, and, you know, it's interesting that you bring up this nature of humanity, excuse me, the nature of humanity, because I was just watching Independence Day earlier today. It was like on constant loop on some station. I think the one thing that we tend to do, period, with anything paranormal, Keith, is anthropomorphize. We tend to want to humanize it. And I think Richard Dolan has a really, really good and measured outlook on it, where as opposed to Stephen Greer, don't get me wrong. I love the work of Stephen Greer. I think he's great as far as disclosure goes, things like that. But when it comes to CE5, I think there's a big problem with assuming the fact that everything out there has our best intent at heart. You know, it's kind of like Carl Sagan said, or not Carl Sagan, but Stephen Hawking said, maybe we should stop beaming messages of our genetic code out to space. Just a thought.
Yeah. Not knowing. Yeah.
Who it's going to end up with. Like, it could end up with like the Skeletor of the galaxy, you know?
Yeah. I mean, yes. Stephen, yes. Dr. Greer. Yeah. He's very knowledgeable. Yeah.
Amazing. Amazing work. Amazing, amazing career. You know, his work with the Disclosure Project. Phenomenal. Phenomenal. But I think that there is and I'm not going like the route of let's lock it all down. It's going to be an attack, you know, Mars attacks or Independence Day or anything like that. But I think that we do have to have a measured amount of caution with how we approach that conversation, much like if you were landing on the shores of an uncharted island and a bunch of people come out and meet you there. There has to be a measured response to how you broach that conversation as your vessel hits the beach.
Yeah. And I mean, that's again, part of a big part of our problem is that there's really not any, there's discussion amongst, you know, some of the either more scientific or ufological, oriented communities, but there's no consensus movement. There's no meaningful movement towards putting a plan of action in place. And I'll mention, if I can remember, if you can remind me, an organization in which Donald Schmidt and I talked about at length in our Facebook Live just this past weekend. But getting back to my other point is that that's exactly where I'm proposing that there's a dearth of work in this area, that we don't have anything prepared. And I'll give you an analogy example of this. Let's put aside any talk to do with ETI. Okay. Now, where the dearth of you mentioned a few minutes ago that, you know, we as our species are starting to travel a little bit into space, whether robotic, vicariously or biologically, whatever. Now, in my proposal, you know, I go take a deep dive in all of the issues coming around with the after the contact and after the acknowledgement, after the EGA, it's the EGR. Well, we're going to need to become involved with things such as legal, exopolitics, exo-law, exo-economics,
exo-treaty writing,
culture. This phenomenon is more than science. It's more than the military. Okay, let's put aside ETI. We're already going to the moon. We've already had China take a flag up there figuratively, stamp it into the moon and say, this is ours. U.S. did the same thing, with maybe not saying it explicitly, but we did.
No, we physically did the same thing. Like we physically did that.
Yeah. Yeah. So
we actively went and stuck a flag on it and said, hey, what's up?
Yeah, beamed it on television and the whole world, the U.S. But thankfully, Neil Armstrong toned that whole thing down with his one statement when he said one giant leap for mankind.
Absolutely. So cool. Absolutely. There's whole episodes you could do about the hypotheses of whether or not we win. I had a great grandmother who would, till the day she died, tell you, nope. We can't, that's Hollywood. We can't do that.
I wish Hollywood could have done that.
She was a very classy old country Cajun lady, though. So, you know, I mean, what can you do? But we all have our beliefs that we hold strong and fast to, Keith, and it is hard sometimes to unseat those beliefs despite being presented with facts to the contrary of belief.
And so much. So, but yeah, so we haven't for our own purposes, we haven't come to any meaningful progress with exo law, exo anything to do with our activities and existence on Earth, projecting that onto a foreign planetary body or whatnot. Yeah. There's nothing in place for any of that. So maybe that is another compelling reason for us to start looking at these, but then never forget the EGR factor that, okay, there's other intelligences out there. So maybe our proactive plan of action could help us for our own species. And also when we start to interact with the EGIs.
Yeah. Well, and number one, yes, our own species. I think that that's where we have to start there, Keith. We have to, and I'm not saying that we have to create a utopian society before an ET civilization will speak to us, or even, because I am prone to believe in it, not that there aren't numerous ET civilizations out there, but that most of the craft that we are seeing that are amongst the anomalous and everything else are more than likely transitional from other dimensions, things like that. And kind of precisely what a lot of the native tribes and ancient civilizations thought, that these things coexisted with us. You just had to be in a different mind state to be able to see them.
Yeah. And that's not necessarily the case either. And that's easily knee-jerk reaction or knee-jerk explanation by many in the professional fields that, oh, all of this was shamanistic.
Yeah.
With no meaning or any denigration to the work of maybe plasma science or whatever, saying no disparaging words about any of that. And it's very, very reasonable and possible to say that, again, knowing the human behaviors, that they recorded what they saw, that some actually did see these things. But it's more than chemical stimulation. It's more than seeing plasma artifacts in the sky during an EMP, EMF of whatever. How will I put this? That's one of the major things that we can learn from our ancients. And again, that's why I stress this so much, is that we have no other analog with which to investigate ourselves and maybe move ourselves in a right direction than the one analog that is our ancients. And again, because they are us, we are them, it's an entirely reasonable, credible, valid analog with which to do this. So, but you know, the one thing that's missing from all of this, and this is the problem, is that our ancients universally had come up with the various codes of existence, the guidance, which whether they were the spiritual guides from gods, deities, very, very extensive throughout all the ancients, also ETIs and whatnot. Their codes of the flower of life, the Kabbalah, tree of life, tree of knowledge.
Yeah.
The guidance that they had, which shows up in architecture, the out of place for a civilization that didn't have the wheel and were able to build pyramids in periods of time, and the scientific applications, or shall I say the scientific attributions to how these things were constructed, all of these out of place artifacts and whatnot that our ancients experienced.
Yeah.
they also had the harmony, the holism, the peace, the way of life. And yes, they were at war with each other, but their codes,
yes,
existence. If you lived a good life, and when your time of transference and passing came, all of the ancients also had their own pearly gates, so to speak, or their Saint Peter, or their 42 ideals of Mott, or purgatory, where if your soul is worthy of going into eternity, or the Great Rift, the Milky Way galaxy, or whatever star constellation, you have to make sure that you lived a good enough life in all of these aspects with which to do it. The samsara, nirvana, a paradigm, the reincarnation and whatnot. They all had these same things. One thing that's missing from all this is the peace, the harmony, the interconnectedness. We don't, the holism. We know of these terms. We don't have it today.
Well, no, we don't. And that is something that we talk about regularly on this show. You know, if you look back to even our great grandparents, you know, they had a different connection. Aside from the Farmer's Almanac, they didn't necessarily need it. They knew when it was time to put crop in, you know, they didn't necessarily need that. They knew when it was time to rotate crop. These were things that were passed down from person to person. And it's interesting to see that, a lot of that even kind of knowledge, when it comes to tradecraft is almost gone. I'm not going to say it's completely gone, because it's still well and alive in many parts of the world, and just not hugely in our Western American society. And just the quick loss of that, how fast that happens. The example I give all the time is I'm Cajun by heritage. You are hard pressed to go and find somebody under the age of 75 years old that speaks Cajun. It's almost gone. And that is a language and culture that is unique to our country. Almost gone. It within one generation, Keith.
As is most of our other Native American tribes and nations.
Yeah.
Yep. It's a very much dying, almost extinct culture.
Well,
I mean, to communicate is part of a culture.
Well, and to be that connected in that kind of way, in a societal way, to the world around you, to the ground around you, to the earth around you, people had a different sense of humility at that point. When the sun went down, it was dark for everyone. You know, there was no electricity across the street. There was no air conditioning for everyone. You know, there was no creature comfort. There may have been a creature nestling somewhere inside of your comfort, as a matter of fact. And that was a common thing. And that was a connection that I think kept us all connected, that kind of communally kept us connected, that we are not connected in that way at all anymore as a society.
Yeah, that's right. And I mean, that's another example and aspect of where our ancients, we don't give them enough credit for intelligence, resourcefulness.
Oh, absolutely.
Craftiness or whatever. Now, I mean, you know, there's many things. You can take your imagination on an out of place artifact, and you can just go wild with it. Like, for example, I was in the Temple of Hathor, the crypt for Dendera. And so I got a firsthand look at, and I didn't touch them, because you don't touch.
No touching.
Writing.
No touching.
Don't touch it. Exactly. That's another conversation. But, you know, so I've got a whole bunch of photo data and studying of Dendera. And, you know, your imagination is that, oh, it was a battery, an ancient light bulb and whatnot. And my initial conclusion, I haven't had a lot of time but I'm saying, no, that was an interpretation of the Milky Way, the Great Rift. And going to study the story around it, I want to see if that hypothesis actually plays out. So, I mean, today we can attribute all of these out of place artifacts or whatever to the want of a UFO ETI explanation or whatnot. And I don't think they were all like that. But that's not going to discount all of them. And it's not to say any of them were hoaxes, but that. Again, our ancients recorded what they saw, and that they were so adept at being able and intelligent to be able to translate the things that they saw and experienced in nature towards guidance. Sometimes it could be physical manifestation of agriculture, being able to grow food, the emergence of a calendar. The astronomy, basically paleo astronomy, that was probably the first scientific profession, along with medicine, that was invented and existed.
Yeah, but the Magi, people who studied the stars, who knew the stars. I mean, there was a difference, you know, between knowing your stars for hunting, fishing, planting, things like that. Those were definitely things that were passed down person to person, but knowing the alignments of planets, things like that, knowing the zodiac, all that kind of stuff, which most stargazing societies had their own version of the zodiac.
Exactly. The sacred geometry, I'll add sacred trigonometry, because I think those two are related in many ways. But the Native Americans depicted star maps of their own. They did have articulate zodiacs, constellations of the night sky. Because there were so many different tribes in existence, there exists a few divergences and differences, but the major players in the night sky were generally agreed upon by disparate Native American tribes, as is more disparate worldwide cultures. The Aborigines had their own, Peru, Mesopotamia, Egypt, the Norse had their own, India and China for sure. See, that's why we also talk too. A lot of the talk is around Western happenings, Western philosophy, and you forget that 2/3 of the world's population throughout history also existed in the Near East, Far East, and Middle East. So
still does. And that's why I preface all of those things when I say, like, trades have gone away. No, they've gone away here. You go to a lot of places, a lot of things are still made by hand, everything else. A lot of those trades and knowledge are still passed on person to person, because that is how their money is made. But here in America, where things have been industrialized, in just about any industrialized country, those things are waning. Those things are going away. Our sense of connectivity as a community and impact upon each other and our local communities upon each other are going away and dwindling. And people like you, Keith, who through their works like the Humaniverse Guide, things like that, are bringing this to light, bringing it to the forefront as the big D disclosure happens, man, because this is the conversation that we need to be having. I've said it in probably the last month and a half, Keith, more than any other, the fact of the conversation around holiday tables has changed. It is no longer like it used to be, where you hear a lot of politic, things like that, you know, and now you're hearing a lot of paranormal conversation. You're hearing a lot of conversation about UFOs, UAPs, that kind of stuff. It's really incredible. Crazy Uncle Chester ain't as crazy as he used to be, is he? You know,
no.
The conversation that's being had. And it's very interesting to see that happening.
and that it's not the ridicule factor is a lot less. You know, the ridicule factor is actually happening more in
the disbelief community,
the science articles.
Yeah.
I mean, Scientific American, when you read titles that say, you know, this researcher is doing this, well, the title continues. Good luck with that. You know, the ridicule.
Yeah.
And I found this in the crowds. I mean, even Roswell now, over the last few years, the crowds, how will I put this? The atmosphere has changed a little bit. Now, we're a sanctuary community.
There are camps, Keith, within all of these communities. And it's interesting. Even within the UFO UAP community, there are camps, you know.
Politics,
It's interesting as somebody who sponsors events in all of these and gets to kind of come and fly on the wall from community to community. It's interesting to see some of that.
But even the mood has changed amongst the visitors.
Oh yeah,
I mean I can tell the ambience when a visitor comes and tells their story. They're a lot more and often they'll have a sig other that you know doesn't agree with their views or denies that they had an experience or whatever.
Oh please God, but don't encourage them. Yeah,
it's not as contentious as it used to be. It is changing, and the visitors still recognize. Hey, it's especially the experiencers, the more the CE4-5s that it is a sanctuary, but so that they are, you know, there's a comfort zone. But they've even become significantly more comfortable now than even just a few years ago, and I think that's the conversation, the narrative. It's continual now. I mean, I did a long YouTube series. I haven't been able to post it all yet, but I took a deep dive into the efforts of 16 different world governments.
Oh yeah, I saw that one. That was fantastic.
In terms of in terms of what that nation is doing towards disclosure efforts and whatnot. So, and it's an ongoing work, but, you know, the United States is certainly not
far behind. In disclosure and putting documentation out and acknowledging anything. We are almost a decade to two decades behind many countries like France, things like that.
Brazil.
Absolutely. Definitely. Keith,
Australia, England.
I want to thank you, as always, for coming on, especially while you're still there enjoying your time in Roswell. Thank you so much. Let everybody know, aside from your YouTube channel, of course, where can they go to follow all of your work? Where can they go to keep up with things? Where can they go to get their copies of the Humaniverse Guide?
Yeah, I'm most active visually, more immediate, on my Facebook channel, which is titled The Humaniverse. And the website, which is also titled The Humaniverse, now that's under revamp. So Sherry's working on that real diligently. She's in the middle of it. So hopefully within a few weeks, I'll be able to do a rollout on that. And we'll have some of my lectures from the past. And Facebook seems to be active, but I've been on the road a lot lately, so it's a little hard to communicate and get all these things packaged and put together. But the books are always available. They'll be on the website. You'll be able to order them directly from the website. But I encourage anybody, Amazon, all the booksellers, Amazon particularly, Google, Apple, Barnes and Noble, some independent stores, local stores and whatnot. And also, of course, at any conference I attend, they'll be available there. And, you know, I'll have signings and things like that. So coming up schedule wise, actually, I'm preparing. I'm going to still detox a little bit from Egypt and put a little bit of that together. Turkey will be in August. And then right after coming back from that, I'll be in Exeter, New Hampshire. Labor Day weekend for their particular conference. Peter Robbins, Kathy Martin again. I've got a definite engagement in Bowie, Baltimore, Maryland in October, Mysteries of Space and Sky.
Oh, cool.
We're working also in October, maybe pretty busy. I'm working with Susan Morgan and also separately the UFO Congress out in Arizona. So there's no definite schedule on those yet, but October could turn out to be a pretty busy month there. But I'll be back stateside after Turkey. So awesome. I got to get out into the glyph fields a little more.
Yeah, precisely. Well, thank you as always for coming on the show, sharing your vast wealth of knowledge as well as the important message of where we are going as a humanity as this disclosure comes. Are we ready for the big conversation with the others, you know, not even amongst ourselves? So, Keith, thank you so much for your time. I greatly appreciate it. I'll be sharing links, all that kind of stuff with you as always, my friend. Take care.
Okay.
And safe travels home.
Okay. In one sentence, I can say we're ready to start a plan of action and we got to do it now. We may not be entirely ready for the EGA, EGR thing, but we have knowledge of it. That's the most important part.
That's right. Keith, thank you again for everything always. Take care of yourself. We'll talk to you soon, my friend.
Okay, Chris, for sure. I'll be in touch, man.
All right. Take care.
Have a good one. Enjoy.
Man, always an amazing conversation with Keith Seelan. I love his work into petroglyphs. Great, great conversations as always. Make sure to go on by, check him out at thehumaniverse.org. While you are online checking out the Humaniverse, of course, stop on by the Curious Realm. CuriousRealm.com is our website. That is where you can go to share your story. If you've had an experience with the paranormal yourself, if you are a targeted individual, if you've seen a UAP, had a paranormal experience, have any evidence of ancient civilizations or monuments, stop on by CuriousRealm.com/story. Fill out our experiencer form. Leave your evidence with us if you like. There's a spot there to be able to put in audio, video, pictures, everything. Make sure to stop on by CuriousRealm.com/videos. That is where you can find the embedded video channels, all of the YouTube channels of our guests. You can subscribe right there. There is Keith Seelan's Humaniverse. And of course, you can go by CuriousRealm.com/store to purchase any of our guest books, including The Humaniverse by Keith Seelan. There it is right there, folks. Thank you so much for tuning in to this segment. Here after commercial break, we will be joined by our good friend and cryptozoologist out of the San Antonio area, Ryan Edwards. We will be talking about the new study that has come out talking about that everybody is quoting as human beings lived with dinosaurs. Human beings lived among dinosaurs has been the title. We will be talking about that sensationalistic title and the facts behind it, as well as the actual science of cryptozoology when we get back after these messages, folks. With the rise in attention to the health benefits of cannabis and cannabinoids, including CBD, True Hemp Science has become one of the premier providers of full-spectrum CBD and CBD-related products. Using a proprietary spagyric process, True Hemp Science extracts maximum benefit from the whole hemp plant. Buds, leaves, stems, seeds, even roots. Every part of the plant is used and then reused to formulate a rich, complex profile of CBD, CBD derivatives, and terpenes guaranteed to provide the relief and benefits you need daily. Visit TrueHempScience.com to experience the best CBD oils, edibles, and topicals on the market today. And use code CURIOUS7 to save 7% off your entire purchase of $50 or more and get 2 25-milligram CBD cookies or brownies free. That website again is TrueHempScience.com and the code is Curious7. Curious Realm Podcast is your source for the latest and greatest news and events in the world of the paranormal, esoteric, and forbidden knowledge. And there's no better way to spark the conversation than with items from the Curious Realm store. Choose from fan favorites like hoodies, mouse pads, coffee mugs, and more. Buy books and items from your favorite Curious Realm guests. Get your hands on the latest gear for paranormal investigations and experiments we discuss on the show. Open your web browser and stop on by the Curious Realm store at curiousrealm.com/store to buy the latest Curious Realm wear and out-of-this-world gifts for yourself, your family, or a mind that you want to open. That website again is curiousrealm.com/store. Have you considered starting a podcast? Looking for a way to make your business a voice of authority in an industry? Then Podcast Cadet is the solution for you. Whether starting a podcast for yourself, your brand, business, school, church, or just plain fun, Podcast Cadet is here to help you navigate the waters of the podcast industry. Specializing in one-on-one consultation and training with industry professionals in fields ranging from podcast technology and editing to distribution, monetization, and even social media strategies, Podcast Cadet tailors their services to the specific needs of you and your podcast. Do you already have a podcast and trying to find ways to engage and grow your audience? Sign up for your Podcast Cadet audit today. And let us help you explore new and exciting ways to leverage your content and elevate your podcast brand to whole new levels. From consultational workshops to affordable podcast production and maintenance packages, Podcast Cadet is your one-stop shop for everything podcast-related on the internet. Visit PodcastCadet.com today to sign up for your consultation or training. And use code CURIOUS20 to save 20% off your entire purchase. That website, again, is podcastcadet.com. Hello, everybody, and welcome back from that commercial break. Thank you so much to all of our sponsors, especially True Hemp Science out there. Christopher Lynch is an amazing alchemist with his CBD brand. It is fantastic stuff. I've used it for years. Stop on by and check it out, folks. TrueHempScience.com is the website that you want to go to. Curious7 is the code that you want to use to save 7% off of your cart of $50 or more and get a free edible along with that. Our guest in this segment is Ryan Edwards. He's the author of Cryptids of the World. He is the host of Cryptid Chronicles. You can find his videos, of course, embedded on our video page at curiousrealm.com. That's where you can go and follow him. You can go by and follow him on his YouTube page, The Cryptid Chronicles. You can find him on Facebook. His book is, of course, for sale in the Curious Realm store, and that is also available on Amazon. Welcome back to the show, Ryan Edwards. How are you doing, my friend?
I'm doing good, Chris. How are you doing?
doing all right. Getting a little harried right now. It's kind of a downswing in my typical AV work for the season, but at the same time, things are ramping up like crazy for paranormal season. I know you're going to be vending out at the upcoming Dogman conference. I'll be providing AV, and of course, out there as a sponsor with Curious Realm, getting all kinds of interviews. But yeah, I'm getting ready for like a month straight of road trip interviews, going out to conferences, things like that. So it's going to be pretty wild, man. I'm looking forward to it.
So am I.
Well, since we last talked, there has been quite a bit going on in the world of cryptids. There's, of course, the cattle mutilations that happened here in Texas. There have been numerous other things. But the one thing that I wanted to have you on to talk about was sensationalism when it comes to cryptozoology. And yes, folks, even your host is prone to use sensationalistic titles. Even in the title of this episode, I put, you know, man lives among dinosaurs. And that is kind of part of the study that, or at least the title of the articles that have been coming out is, human ancestors lived among dinosaurs prior to, the asteroid extinction. And it's a new study that's come out. It's in Current Biology. The title of it, folks, is A Time Scale for Placental Mammal Diversification Based on Biocene Modeling of the Fossil Record. Now, the important part of that actual title is the placental mammal diversification part. because any mammal pretty much gives birth via placenta. Unless they're a marsupial, something like that. So let's kind of start cracking this nut, Ryan, about the world of cryptozoology, the world of, I guess, crypto history in this case, even, and just sensationalism when it comes to things and the difference between sensationalism and fact.
Of course. It was like, would any field, you're always going to have that sensationalistic aspect, especially with cryptozoology. A lot of people see that as a romanticized science of like people going in a jungle or in the woods looking for monsters that shouldn't exist, and like very like Indiana Jones like, I like to say. And honestly, truly, a lot of cryptozoology isn't like that. It is about the science and not the sensation. They're like with these current articles that are stating human ancestors live alongside dinosaurs. I look at it, I'm like, of course we did. All mammals originated around the Jurassic into the Cretaceous period with the dinosaurs.
Yeah.
But humans weren't walking around. Like bipedal apes like us weren't walking around beside dinosaurs, of course. But that's what people think when they first read the article and read the title, and they get that sensationalistic, like, oh, humans, us, like me and you live alongside dinosaurs. And a lot of times people just look at the title and then don't even read the article in it in and of itself.
Oh, that's precisely it. You know, it's a topic that we cover on the show regularly, Ryan, the idea of just the filter being clogged, and not just the filter being clogged, but people not even using a trowel to scrape past the surface. They're willing to accept something prima facie, especially if that prima facie evidence will feed into or confirm their belief.
Yes. And you always have that confirmation bias. But like when people see anything that even remotely helps support their ideas, they won't even investigate it. They'll just automatically accept it. Because they believe they're automatically correct with their ideas. Which, one thing with cryptozoology is always that you can't always believe they're right, and that's with any science. You can always have that skepticism there. You always have to believe, okay, a lot of times, especially like with Bigfoot field or Dogman field, a lot of people take their hypotheses as truth and not as just theories. Theories aren't proven yet. Until the species or whatever is proven, then your theory becomes fact. Like, even gravity still classifies as just a hypothesis, even though we know it exists.
Yeah. I mean, we can detect gravitational waves, things like that, but it is still theoretical. And I mean, things like that are proven all the time. A prime example would be the Nobel Prize this last year going to quantum entanglement and the idea that particles can be entangled via distance and affect and effect each other via distance. So, I mean, these are things that have been considered and thought about for years, but not really proven until recently, and hypothesized, and beyond hypothesized, theorized, you know, equations were written and people were like, well, you know, maybe the equation's there, might be the case. But it wasn't until recently that it was actively proven.
Yes.
So, yeah, I mean, it's interesting because whenever we have you on, I always love talking about the demystification of things. The one thing that I love about your research, Ryan, and the way that you approach research is you try to tie together not just the histories of cryptids, creatures, things like that, but the actual science and paleontology as well.
Yes, because like how I see it, like of course, cryptozoology is a science.
Sure.
It shouldn't be seen as some type of monster hunt or some type of like, oh, a bunch of people going into woods looking for monsters. That's not what this is about. Of course, it's field research, but it truly should be classified as a science. And all of it should be having that idea of science collecting and the data behind it. And especially with cryptids, especially modern cryptids, I see a lot of this very unscientific viewpoints of these creatures. Like, for instance, I look at like the dogman phenomena and the goatman phenomena, and you look at animals that truly cannot be animals in and of themselves because they don't comply to anatomical and biological principles. So you have to kind of think outside the box for that. Either these creatures are just misidentifications, or there's something totally different from what we believe as a physical creature. And that's when we kind of get into the more paranormal aspect of cryptozoology, which is something that is outside of really the scientific viewpoint of cryptozoology. It's more paranormal in nature.
Yeah, precisely. And, I think, once again, that is a big problem and a big misnomer. Whenever people hear cryptozoology, that is the first thing that they jump to. Is Bigfoot and other paranormal examples of things when in fact, you know, yeah, like you're saying, cryptozoology is really just the study of animals that are outside of the norm, animals that have been talked about even tribally for decades, millennia sometimes. And it's interesting because even the sensationalized topic of, you know, man living next to dinosaurs and our ancestors living next to dinosaurs. There have been numerous cases of dinosaur-like critters that have been reported by tribes for hundreds of years. Cave drawings and all sorts of things that are very reminiscent of dinosaurs. So even to try and think about the fact that there may have been some dinosaurs that survived beyond the asteroid extinction into the time of humanity, sure.
Yes, like, for instance, like, of course, we have the stories of the litany of cryptids down in Africa, like Mokema Bembe, Emile Matoka, Naguna Monin, which are believed to be dinosaur-like, from the sauropod-like Mokema Bembe to the pterosaur-like Kongamata. So, and these indigenous languages, and they talk about these dinosaur-like cryptids, but a lot of times that is something that is kind of a misnomer that people don't realize, is that when you look at the original, like, oral histories of these creatures, they're describing much very different creatures. Like, for instance, Mokey Mbembe, for instance. The Lingala people, when talking about the Mokey Mbembe, originally were talking about a creature that more resembles maybe a giraffe or a rhinoceros. Mm. But what occurred during the late colonial period when the European settlers first entered Africa, they took these stories and kind of made them into, like, living dinosaurs, because that's what was really common back then. Like, Sir Arthur Conan Doyle's book, The Lost World, and these ideas of living prehistoric creatures. And if you look at even the descriptions of these quote-unquote dinosaurs, they're very culturally anachronistic. They're referencing creatures that really we now know from the fossil record didn't really exist, or they didn't really look like this. They don't reference feathers. They don't reference really anything that looks like it's warm-blooded. So we have to believe, like, okay, how is maybe the European settlers putting their own spin on it, and also how is just the culturally ideas being affected by outside cultures? Like, we see throughout the history of cryptozoology, once cultures mix, usually the original cultures' ideas of mythology and creatures get somehow bastardized by the entering culture. Another example of this is, of course, the Wendigo, the Algonquin tradition. Like, the Wendigo initially was talked about to be more of a pale humanoid, almost like what people think of the like rake nowadays. But thanks to the European idea of the lycanthropes as vampires and werewolves, they got turned into what we now see as a bipedal deer. So we see this bastardization occur many times within cultures, and how the original ideas get almost so murkied that we can't find them anymore. And then with this idea of, like, sensationalism and, like, creating something that's even scarier, also affects it as well. Like, if you say, okay, I saw a bear in the woods and it's like the size of a black bear, okay, that's not really anything. But you say it's the size of a grizzly, you create that story even more sensational, even though it's not true. And you see that occur many times within cryptozoology.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. And even to the extent of stories being embellished sometimes to the taste of the researcher, so to speak, especially whenever I've heard it from quite a few researchers, whenever they're taking oral stories from people and accounts and witness accounts, somebody in the background will chime up like, oh, yeah, don't forget there was this. Oh, yeah, yeah. And it's hard not to do that. You know, even talking with Josh Wolf Turner about his Dogman experience. In his Dogman sighting when he was younger, that he has to strive hard to listen to other people's experiences and not have it color his experience whenever he retells his story, you know.
Yes.
And to make sure that, like, he's not accidentally, because I mean, hey, I hear a lot of accounts too, you know. And they can be hard not to muddle together. They can be hard not to remember, like, Joni said this, Chachi said that. Especially not to take that into your own narrative, you know?
Yes. And, like, even I'll bring up examples of, like, how modern-day cryptids are even almost affecting cryptids that have already been existing. Like, for instance, in recent decades, I've been doing research into, like, cryptids here in Texas. We have cryptids that have seen, for instance, I'll give an example of the creature seen up in Vidor, Texas. Mm. If you've heard Ken Gerhardt talk about this, initially people were referencing something that looked more Bigfoot-like. But in recent years, thanks to the Dogman phenomenon becoming more plethorous and more common, people are more like, oh, that sounds more like a dog man. So you have to think, was this creature initially described as Bigfoot because all people knew was Bigfoot? Or is this creature maybe a dog man because people are putting their own modern day preferences onto a pre-existing creature. And you have to think about this occurring especially with the Bigfoot and Dogman field, because this Dogman phenomena is affecting the Bigfoot research as well. Like, a lot of people were saying, well, what if this creature wasn't Bigfoot and now it's actually a Dogman? And it kind of muddies the water in the whole field of cryptozoology itself.
Well, sure, sure. And I mean, even we've had the conversation before, you and I, on the air a couple times about the idea of the marriage of these phenomena, Dogman, other cryptid phenomena with other paranormal phenomena, you know, portals, UFOs. The instances of both of them being reported at the same time seems to be growing. And seems to be increasing, and you come to the point of scientific quandary. And yes, folks, I say scientific quandary, of how do you explore this? How do you research it? At what angle do you begin approach, the portal or the Bigfoot? You know?
Yes.
Because now you're talking about two phenomena concurrently occurring. You know, and neither one of them is fully. And now, granted, we have plenty of proof for portals, and I've got my air quotes up here for you audio listeners. Portals, the fact that there are actually portals in the Earth's magnetic field, that there are actual holes in the Earth magnetic field that traverse and go from one point to another, things like that. It's pretty wild. There is even a super highway amongst the Milky Way and amongst the cosmos of slipstreams that you can follow, of like gravitational waves, really wild stuff. So not saying that portals as described in the experiences could not exist. It's going to take us proving portal and Bigfoot. And then you're going to have the quandary of did the Bigfoot make the portal? And if so, how? You know? And you've stepped into a whole noodle pile of questions when it comes to marrying the paranormal experiences together. And I am not going to say that is not people's experience, that is not the experience that they've had, that is not what they've witnessed. I'm just saying that you step into a whole nother world of investigation when that is the case.
Yes. And like how I always say, just because two things are occurring consecutively doesn't mean they're necessarily causing one another. Like correlation does not mean causation. Like with the idea of
absolutely.
Like Sasquatches and portals or Sasquatch and UFO sightings. Just because these two events are occurring doesn't mean one is causing one another. Like, a lot of people, like, for instance, if you look at places like Skinwalker Ranch or these locations where a lot of peculiar phenomena occur at the same time, you have to wonder, are they causing one another? Or is it just some type of something that causes them to occur at the same time but not causing one another? Like, when you look at, for instance, like, Dogman sightings and like people seeing orbs. A lot of people believe these are two events causing one another. And not necessarily. Like every time someone sees an orb, not like they see a Dogman or a Bigfoot. And not like every time someone sees a Bigfoot, they see an orb. So you have to wonder if these are just two events that are occurring at the same time, but not causing one another.
Yeah. Yeah, precisely. And like you said, correlation is not causation. We have that discussion with our good friend Stephen Myers all the time. Just because something seems to go together doesn't mean the fact that they are the same or that one is due to the other.
Yes. Like, for instance, I always say that if you're like a little kid and you clap your hands and then thunder hit. As a child, you're like, oh, did I cause that? But that's just because you don't have that precognition to think, okay, no, I didn't cause that. But a lot of times with the human psyche, we like correlating things. We, of course, we like mysteries, but in the end, we really don't. We like solving mysteries. So with us, with humans, we like to see two peculiar phenomena, two unknown events like UFOs and Bigfoot. And in the back of our minds, we correlate these two because they're both unknown. But while in reality, it should not be seen like that. Like, an example I always give people is like, okay, if you want to go look for a cryptid book in the library, where do you look? You look where they have UFOs and ghosts. You don't look in the animal section. You don't look in the prehistory section. You look in the UFO and demonology, dream research, and all that stuff all in one section. And that's why I believe with cryptozoology in and of itself, it's taken as a more of a paranormal field and not as a biological field, because I personally believe cryptozoology is the first step of zoology. You have to first take an animal is there in order to discover it. Yeah. And that's where people take sensationalistic, like, oh, cryptozoology is about hunting monsters and finding ghosts and going and looking after UFOs. And that's not what this research is about. It's about the discovery of an unknown species, or even, like, one thing that people forget about cryptozoology, misplaced species. Like the idea of, like, a tiger in Texas. That's technically cryptozoological. Or the litany of kangaroo sightings in the American Midwest. That's classified as cryptozoology because it's an animal that's not supposed to be there. Even if it's an exotic animal trade, that's still an animal that's non-indigenous that people don't know the origins of, so it becomes cryptozoological. Like, I'll give an example, like the eastern cougar. The cougars I've seen along the eastern seaboard, that's technically cryptozoological. And even in recent years, the cougars have been seen here in the south, here in central Texas. That's technically cryptozoological because these cougars are outside of their natural home ranges. So when does cryptozoology take over and when does zoology take over? That's kind of the question a lot of cryptozoologists have to ask themselves.
Yeah, precisely. And I mean, it's interesting because we have numerous things like that here in Texas, the jaguarless, all kinds of things. So to see that and to see the once again, the misplacement and misidentification of other animals and to not consider that in the realm at the same time, because there are numerous cases. I mean, here in Texas, we had quite a fiasco with a big cat guy here in the San Antonio area many years ago who let some of his cats go. He was running like a big cat hunt type thing where you could go out and like hunt lions and stuff like that. That is a thing, you know. I mean, right now, even to think of the pythons that are taking over the Florida Everglades, stuff like that, where it's a released species, it's been let go, and there happened to be enough of them that they found each other and started mating, you know. And is it a possibility that other big cat species could crossbreed with a cougar or a mountain lion? Sure, possibly. But more than likely, a lot of these sightings, like you said, are explained by other species that have been released, stuff like that.
Yes. Like the whole black cat phenomenon in the United States. Like when people see large black cats. Like a lot of people believe these are mountainous cougars, which that's a possibility. But one big issue is that within captivity and the wild, there's been no reference to a mountainous cougar. Even the genome of the Felis concula or mountain lion doesn't have a gene that would allow for melanism to occur. Neither would albinism occur. So you kind of have to question that, like, okay, so what are these creatures? What are people seeing? Are they released jaguars? Are they released leopards that are melanistic? And when you look at the history of these sightings, a lot of them don't go that too far back. And you have to wonder, like, okay, are these maybe circus animals that were released and then bred in the wild, similar to the big cats in Britain, which the British government do say there is a population of big cats breeding in the British Isles because there's how many sightings there are. And you have to wonder, like, okay, So with these released big cats, is this something cryptozoological or is it zoological? Like, who takes care of this? Does your local cryptozoologist or does the local forestry worker? Because we know the creatures are out there, but because it's an unknown species or a species that's not supposed to be there, usually the forestry service or regular animal research entities don't want to go into it because of the whole idea of, like, even the idea of cryptozoology not being just sensationalistic, but also being just a bunch of kooks out there looking for monsters.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, and nothing against anybody that is out Sasquatch hunting or anything like that. I mean, as long as you are following good evidentiary procedure, you know, carrying a GPS, cataloging things in the most scientific way possible, by all means, go out and citizen science it up.
Yes.
But if you're just traipsing around with some trail cameras and highlighting shadows, that's a different story. And there are, I regularly discuss with folks from MUFON investigators, things like that, some of the many, many errors and issues with things like trail cameras, you know, ring cameras, anything with a rewritable media inside of it.
Yes.
You know, like you could go, I've got an SD card right here in front of me that I use for my astrophotography. And every time I'm done with it, I format it and I put it back in my camera and I take new pictures and then I'm done with it and I format it. Guaranteed, if this hand fell into the hands of a law enforcement officer involved with the trade of data recovery, they could go back and recover parts of images from 8-9 memory wipes ago. You know?
Yes.
There are always bits of data in there. There's always bits of corruption. There's always, it's not that it isn't great to use it as a means, but as our good friend King Gerhard says, is a photo going to be the evidence that proves it? Likely not.
Yes. Like, how I see it is like also the idea of different levels of evidence. Things like video, eyewitnesses, and all that should be what lead up to the discovery. And discovery should hopefully be based on,
yes,
hopefully biological DNA sampling or a body or something like that. That's the proof, not the eyewitness and photos. Those are what leads up to the proof.
Exactly.
That's what tells researchers, okay, this animal possibly exists in this area. Let's go see if we can find possible DNA samples, hair samples, things like that.
Yeah.
But a lot of people take these eyewitness accounts as, oh, this is proof this creature exists, which this really isn't proof in of itself. This is just anecdotal references and not true empirical data.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, the way I try to put it to folks, is especially whenever I'm talking with them one-on-one, And that is what they bring up, is I have this proof. If you were sitting in the defendant's chair, would that be the proof? You know, like if yeah, that was the evidence to go to defend your life right now and keep you out of prison, would that be the proof? You know, or would it be allowed by the court at all? You know, would it be considered circumstantial evidence? Would it be considered hearsay? You know,
yes.
Because that's where it has to begin. And you have to be willing to. I have numerous pictures of anomalies, things. I took a picture of an anomaly on the moon. And a really cool dude who's pretty high up in the world of budget astronomy and things like that got back to me on Facebook and like put this whole explanation of what it was. And I was like, okay, that was pretty dope. But at the same token, I caught an anomaly. It's wild. It's an interesting thing. Is it like a tower or a spire from an ancient civilization on the moon? No, it's not. Is it a wild, interesting thing to photograph? And even the guy who explained it to me was like, you did a really great job capturing this because not many people get a good image of it. You know, like, hey, I got a 10% great image of an anomaly that 90% of people don't even know exist. You know, I can be happy with that. It doesn't have to be a 1-2% anomaly of, well, it might be alien, you know. We can let it rest on the fact of it's something pretty wild and something really geologically interesting that I was able to get a picture of. And you have to be willing to step back from that. If you're not willing to step back from that, then you have to start questioning whether or not you're looking at something objectively to begin with.
You always have to be objective with it.
I mean, you've got to be able to look at it objectively and like, hey, I've had my own experiences with the paranormal, and they are what they are. I do not accept anybody or expect anybody to accept them prima facie, to accept them for what they were to me and how they changed me. I didn't go into the situation expecting something to happen. Something just happened and it was really strange, you know, and I'm happy to have had the experiences, and they've definitely changed my way and my point of view. But are they quantifiable? No, they aren't, Ryan. And I have to be willing to accept the fact that my experiences are not quantifiable in that way.
Yes. Like, how I always say is, with anyone's personal accounts, eyewitness accounts, absolutely, or experiences, it's not quantifiable. It's data, of course, but it's data that shouldn't lead to people believing something exists or having proof that exists. Like, people always say, well, if there's 100 Bigfoot sightings and one is true, then that's proof that it's real. Yes, it's evidence that that creature exists, of course, but it's not technically proof. There is that evidence you have to collect afterwards. And we also still have that whole, like, especially with Bigfoot research in the past decade, that's the facialistic aspect of, like, even the money-making aspect of Bigfoot. Like, look how many small towns say they have Bigfoot near them, so they start having Bigfoot shops. They start being tourism. And the idea of, like, crypto-tourism is something that's occurred in the past couple of decades, thanks to the sensationalistic aspect of, like, people out there looking for creatures that shouldn't exist.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, once again, I discourage nobody from doing research, from doing field research, things like that. Just make sure that you're doing it in the most proper way, whether it's paranormal research for ghosts and entities, or, you know, I just got an anomaly detector for magnetic and electronic phenomena for UAPs, you know. All kinds of gear and toys I have, but it's just points of datum for me. I can't say until the day that I see something and take photograph or video, and even then, the photograph or video, I'd expect to be put through the ringer. You know?
Yes.
I was just rereading a story earlier today about the gentleman who not once but twice, out of the San Antonio area, had the story of having the body of a Bigfoot, you know, and that is what a lot of people say it will take, especially when it comes to cryptozoology, when it comes to creatures of myth, fable, whether you're talking Bigfoot or Nessie or Champ, the Lake Champlain monster, what have you, that it's going to take DNA evidence and probably a body to actively prove the existence of these animals.
Yes. And, like, and one thing I always try to tell people that are interested in this, especially when people try to get into it, don't let yourself also get discouraged by that. Like, a lot of people say, well, like, if it takes so much to prove a species exists, why should they even do it in the first place? And I always say, don't let yourself get discouraged. Like, when you go out there Bigfooting, 9 times out of 10, you're not going to get any evidence, but that's what's expected. And, like, the idea of, like, collecting evidence scientifically and being able to be out there, not just out there to go look for monsters, but out there like truly collecting evidence. That's how we will collect data sets. We can like get ideas like where these animals are, what are they doing, the behaviors. And that's what we really need in the science right now, is just this scientific viewpoint and not letting ourselves become this sensationalistic aspect of like monster hunting. Like, I support anyone that wants to go out there and look for these creatures, because this is the difficulty of doing it in the first place. But don't let yourself get discouraged if your evidence is lacking or if you can't find evidence in the first place. There's a reason why these animals haven't been discovered yet.
Yeah, well, and that's just it. Like, you are searching for the anomalous. And even prime example would be the director of Arrow, the acronym for the All Domain Anomaly Reconnaissance Office, the new office that's in charge of UAP studies, things like that. They have a reported, even them, they say that 2 to 5%, there's a 2 to 5% deviation where there's like 2 to 5% that we just cannot explain, you know? And that's not to say that there weren't a lot of questions with the other stuff and that they didn't create a noodle scratcher for a long time, but they were explainable. You're going to get a lot of the explainable, and that's okay. It takes a lot of the explainable to find an anomaly to begin with, much less. And this is my message to anybody that's out there that has repeated anomaly. Consider the fact that it may not be anomaly. Just consider it, look into it, you know. Start looking at some regular everyday explanations for the phenomena that you might be recording. If you were recording UFOs, UAPs in your backyard every 3-4 days, you'd be selling tickets, you know. same thing if you were, you know, contacting Bigfoot or seeing Bigfoot in your backyard 3-4 times a week. Like, yeah, I can appreciate the wanting to protect them as well, but that seems to be the going cause for everybody that has regular connection with one, you know? And that in and of itself, you have to be willing to question, you know? Well, let me invite me over on a Tuesday night whenever they come over. Oh, no. That would impose upon them. So we have to be willing to call those things into question. But to not call them into question is to not be looking at things scientifically. And there's, once again, as you're saying, plenty of cause and plenty of reason to look at the science of things behind this.
Yes. Like, how I see it, science should always be, like, number one pursuit of this research. Like, not the sensationalistic aspects of it, but the true science behind this. And I think that's something that a lot of people forget. They forget that cryptozoology, ufology, or paranormal research should be seen as a science and not as the sensationalistic aspects of paranormal research.
Yeah. Yeah, well, and that's kind of exactly what the head scientists for NASA said in their big panel that happened recently. Was like, it's our job as scientists. Why are we not exploring this anomaly? Just because it's an anomaly, and out of the ordinary, doesn't mean that we shouldn't be studying it. That's where science comes from.
Yeah.
Science comes from studying the anomalous. Like, we aren't doing our job, literally. So to hear them say that is fantastic. And to hear them wanting to correct course is awesome. And even here lately, I think because of a lot of that, there has been a large change toward the world of cryptozoology, I believe.
Yes, like people are seeing it as more what it should be seen as, like, okay, there's a unknown phenomenon occurring. Just because it's unknown doesn't mean you should not investigate it. Like, that's what you said. That's the first, like, that's the first step of science, is discovering the anomaly and then discovering what it is. That's what science is about. And that's just something that also I've noticed with cryptozoology, especially with a lot of cryptozoologists, they see the scientific field as, like, letting them down or as ignoring Bigfoot and all these other cryptids. While in reality, I believe science should really take a look at it, because, like, look at people like Jeff Meldrum. Like, he's a scientist that once he looked at the phenomena, he realized, oh, there's something to this. And then you go on to even further research, and you discover what truly this all this is about, and you discover more about the species. When you discover more about species, then hopefully one day the next step will be discovery of the species itself.
Yeah, yeah, precisely. But first, you've got to even be considering the fact that there may be a species there.
You know?
You've got to be looking at the fact that it may actively exist. On occasion, you stumble across things, stuff like that. But typically, you are in a location, whether you're a marine biologist, what have you, you're in a location because of a known quantitative, you know? Most expedition science is not done by stabbing in the dark. Let's just put it that way. It is done because of good boots on the ground, points of datum, and a data set that let you know that this is an area of interest. This is somewhere to look at. And whether you're talking anomaly or what have you, like, there's a lot of people that are really upset with, it's funny to see in Facebook groups, people calling into question the quote scientific method of the people investigating things at, Skinwalker Ranch. And it's like, wow, I guess you know more than the degree holding physicist about scientific protocol. Most of what they are trying to do is repeat the anomaly, which is science, folks.
Yeah.
Like, they've recorded the anomaly. Great. Now, what can we do to repeat it? Because until we can repeat it, it's just a one-off thing. And that can take a while to happen. That can take a while to quantify. So the thing is, you have to be willing to take the time. You have to be willing to search for that and look for the quantification of it. Ryan, what can people do to, I guess, begin exploring alternatives when it comes to education on such things? Where can they go to find data on this? Where can they go to find good data on cryptid research, on paleontology, things like that?
Well, with me, I always say try to look in your local area. Try to look to see if there's any local groups or, like, local cryptozoologists. Like, for instance, myself, I got really lucky that I have King Gerhard that lives in the area, and that we have multiple events that occur. If you are interested in the study, one thing I highly recommend is going to, like, conferences, going to a local, like, Bigfoot research fair or anything like that that they might have in the area, and talk to people, talk to the researchers. And then also, if you want the good, true data, look at, like, national groups like the BFRO or the National Dogman Project. These are groups of people that are putting out good research, and that it's truly scientifically based. And then once you can find your group or find a researchers that you like, communicate with them, communicate with local people in the area. And then if you're interested in truly doing, like, field research in the area you are, just ultimately be safe. It's all about safety out there when it comes to field research. And even though this really isn't monster hunting, be prepared for whatever you might get yourself into. Like, if you're out looking for Bigfoot in Alaska, be prepared for the fauna in Alaska. If you're looking for Sasquatch in the swamp, in the swamps of Louisiana, be ready for the fauna that live in Louisiana. Think of survival situations as well. But truly remember that at the end of the day, it's about the science of cryptozoology. It's about the discovery of these creatures, yes. But I think, in my mind, the person that has 10 years of research that has data sets is more likely to discover this creature than the local person with a 12-gauge shotgun. I believe it's about the science behind this, not just out there looking for these creatures, but truly the data, the research, and really the hard work that goes into this. And it's not just the sensationalistic aspects of like going out there looking for unknown creatures. Think of it as a science, because this truly is.
Yeah, absolutely. Very, very well said. Ryan, thank you so much for your time, as always, my friend, to come on and really demystify this stuff. Because once again, headlines can really, really sensationalize things a lot. And when it comes down to it, much like most issues, cryptozoology, the paranormal, things like that, there is a common sense reality that is going on behind the sensationalism. So thank you so much for coming on and helping us kind of boil that down and talk with people about it. Let everybody know, of course, other than the Curious Realm store, where they can go to buy your book, where they can go to follow you and keep up with all your research, bud.
Of course. You can find my book on Amazon, Solid Cryptids of the World, authored by me, Ryan Edwards. You can always find thecryptochronicles.net. That's my website. I have my podcast there. For my YouTube channel, The Crypto Chronicles. I also have my Facebook, which is Ryan Edwards. If you look me up on Facebook or on Instagram or anything like that, you'll find me. If you want instant in contact with me, if you have any type of experiences or anything you want to talk about, please contact me at my email. I also have ryanedwards.crypto@gmail.com. That is my main email. Reach out to me. I'm always open on talking to researchers, talking to eyewitnesses, because truly it is you guys that are also out there in the field that I'm interested in talking to.
Absolutely. Ryan, thank you so much, as always, for your time, my friend. Be safe out there with your research. Look forward to seeing you at the upcoming Dogman Conference. I know you'll be there vending. Make sure to stop on by and check that out, everybody. Hold the line real quick while we close things out. Ryan, while you are online checking out all of the amazing work of Ryan Edwards, of course, make sure to stop on by Curious Realm. CuriousRealm.com is where you can find our Curious Realm videos page. That's where you can find Ryan's YouTube. The YouTube channel of all of our guests is embedded right there. You can also find the Curious Realm store, where you can buy all of the books and works from our guests. Thank you so much, everybody, for tuning in. As always, take care of each other. Take care of yourselves. Remember, stay curious, and we'll talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
Thank you for tuning into this episode of The Curious Realm. Stay tuned for more guests, forbidden topics, and hidden truths. Download the official Curious Realm app and view the Knowledge Vault on our website, CuriousRealm.com. Follow us on social media by searching Curious Realm. Curious Realm is available on your favorite podcast services, as well as YouTube, Roku, Amazon Fire, and Apple TV through the APR TV app, available on all app markets. Curious Realm is a proud member of the HC Universal Network family of podcasts. For more great content or to become a sponsor of Curious Realm or other podcasts, visit hcuniversalnetwork.com today. Thanks for listening. Stay curious. And remember, the other side is always watching.